Hello, everybody. Welcome back to This Weird House. I am Nick Bodick. Real quick, something I have forgotten to do on every previous episode is please leave a review and rate this wherever you're listening to it. But keep in mind, I'm a very fragile human being, so when you leave your review, make sure it is positive. But to move on to what people actually care about, I have an incredible guest today. And I actually mean incredible. He's one of the most celebrated authors of all time, Mr. Ramsey Campbell. How are you, sir?
Hey, I'm okay. I mean, unlike you, I'm not human, but that's a minor matter.
I think you've made that clear through your words. Yes. Firstly, I really appreciate you coming on. It is truly an honor. I know I've spoken to you before, but it's just every time I get to, it's awesome.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. You bet.
So I just kind of just want to talk to you on this podcast. I started because I like. The way I've put it is I like talking to people about the things I like talking to the people who make the things I like about the things I like, and you make things I like very much. Wow. So I just kind of want to talk to you about the genre just in general.
Okay.
What got you interested in writing horror?
Oh, so you want the 90 minute answer, do you, presumably, to that one?
By all means.
No, I'll try and truncate it as best I may. Lordy, I mean, I've loved the field ever since I can recall, and it's a question of when did I really, you know, become aware of it. I mean, in terms of reading adult fiction, I was 6 years old, and my mother was then letting me use her adult ticket at the local public library to take books out. And I'm not absolutely certain which the very first book was, but I think it was either Great Short Stories of the World, or it was 50 Years of Ghost Stories, which is an anthology of, you know, some of the greats. But if it was Great Short Stories of the World, well, that included The Telltale Heart. And at 6 years old, that's pretty strong meat, you know, and I found it deeply disturbing, and rather felt I'd better not let my mother see I'm reading this, otherwise, you know, it'll be spirited away immediately. So I didn't. Although, strangely enough, I know not strictly horror, but there was a story in that book that haunted me at least as much as the Poe, called A Dark Brown Dog. Do you know it at all? Does that ring a bell?
I'm not familiar with that one.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's very much a sort of slice of you know, seedy life. It's set in a tenement block, and basically, it's this family living on an upper floor. The father, as I recall, is a drunkard, and there's a little toddler who befriends this dog. And basically, one day, the father comes, staggers home, you know, having drunk an enormous amount, and as a joke, as I remember this, chucks the dog out the window or off the balcony. Now, you know, we're a lot of stories up. And we then have this anguished description of this kid having to climb down all the stairs, you know, one step at a time, you know, having to, you know, use all his limbs to get down. And then they just found him just cradling this dead dog. The end. And, you know, that really, you know, shook me
That's
up.
It's horrifying.
Well, I know. It's, as I say, not strictly a horror story, but clearly, you know, you could see my point.
And sure.
For decades, I was convinced this was an Arthur Morrison story, and that it was in his collection Tales of Mean Streets, you know, because it sounds like it should be. Actually, no, it's Stephen Crane, famed for The Red Badge of Courage, filmed by John Huston. And, you know, it's just this sort of four-page short story, and I eventually discovered the book again, reread it, and it's just as powerful. However, if indeed, you know, it was 50 Years of Ghost Stories that got me going, well, that certainly is where my love of being terrified by the uncanny tale started, really. And, I mean, again, I was 6 years old. There were stories in that. Actually, my mother said, look, you mustn't read The Turn of the Screw. That's not quite nice. So at the time, I didn't read that. Though I did read, and I have to confess, you know, I was hideously, monstrously precocious. So, you know, Wilbur Waitley and the Dunwich Horror had nothing on me. And so I was reading Edith Wharton, I'm reading here when I was 6 years old. Story in there called Afterward, which is a ghost story. And believe me, I got it. You know, I got exactly what was going on. I was duly terrified. But there was one story in particular, and I couldn't remember the title for years. I just remembered two images from it, in one of which somebody is opening a chest of drawers searching for something. And at the bottom drawer, there's just sort of, you know, heaps of linen. And then a little pink hand comes groping out, toward them. And then the other, somebody else, I think another lucky character in the same tale, goes into a room in the dark and feels there's some presence in there, and then finds what he describes as sort of gigantic insect feelers groping over his face. Now, you can well imagine a six-year-old a number of uneasy nights after that. It was only, well, I don't know how much longer, I think it probably was only when I got A Collected Stories Of, that I was, it was by M.R. James. So that was my first encounter with M.R. James, that, you know, that great genius of supernatural dread. And really, this is really, I suppose, where my love of the field began. And from that point onward, you know, anything in the library that was of that kind, or science fiction, because not that many supernatural horror anthologies in the library in those days. I mean, there were a bit of a premium. There was a lot more science fiction, though, you know, August Derleth's anthologies, Groff Conklin, Bleeler and Dicty, all these guys that I was reading, Frederick Pohl. So, you know, I got a real baptism of fire in science fiction as well as supernatural horror. And, you know, these are areas I've loved ever since.
That's awesome. Man, that dog story just sounds so bleak and depressing.
Yeah, well.
The story of insect feelers coming out of the dark, that is exactly the kind of story that would have just ruined my life at 6 years old. That would have terrified me.
Mind you, eight years old, you see, I read The Color Out of Space, Lovecraft, in a Groff Conklin anthology. And I, you know, I'd already read a fair number of tales in the field by now, obviously, you know, 2 years later after that first encounter. But I genuinely felt that it's almost forbidden. This is almost going too far. I'm also going to have this thing, you know, if my mother sees what I'm reading, you know, that's it. So I've got to conceal it.
Feels like
from
you're doing something wrong.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Because it was just that much almost too visceral, you know. Again, despite that, you know, it's a very indirectly narrated story, much of it. Again, I got exactly what was going on in it, and you know, it was all the more powerful for the reticence, as I think, you know, much of the greatest horror fiction is.
Oh yeah, definitely. That actually brings me into my next question. A lot of your fiction, it's very Lovecraftian. I'm just kind of curious, what was it about Lovecraft's work or Lovecraft's style of writing, the kind of horror that he wrote and is now named after him? What did you connect with there that so much of your work is in that subgenre?
Oh, well, the sense of the cosmic, you know, the aspiration towards awesomeness, if you like. Because I have to explain this, you see. I say I read The Color Out of Space, I read a few more minor stories in anthologies. But by 1960 in Britain, there had never been a single paperback of Lovecraft. None. And only one hardcover collection, in fact, back in the early 50s, which I never saw. Now, comes 1960, and I find not even a bookshop window, it's a sort of combined grocery store and bookshop, a suburban place in Liverpool. I find a copy of Cry Horror, which actually Don Walheim, who later set up Door Books, he edited this, I think, back in the late 40s for Avon, as I remember it. And this was a reissue, with a wonderful cover by Richard Powers, this sort of ghastly, rotting, almost inhuman shape, which I assume is the Outsider, actually, Lovecraft's Outsider. It looks that way. Anyway, this was a complete collection of Lovecraft, including The Color Out of Space, which I hadn't read for, well, must have been 8 years, actually, 8 years since I've read it. And, you know, half a crown, which, you know, was a lot of money in those days, believe me. So, you know, I was sort of grubbing about in my pocket and convinced that if I went away and got the money, it would be gone and I'd never see it again. And, you know, the last farthing I found in my pocket just made up the half a crown. So I was able to plonk all this, you know, brass on the counter and buy the book. And then skived off school the next day, read the entire thing from cover to cover, and was just utterly immersed in Lovecraft, not just the cosmic vision, but, you know, the style and the way that everything in the story, you know, very much in the poesque mold, you know, is geared toward the effect of that story, which, of course, you know, Lovecraft's great contention, and that's how supernatural horror should be organized. But you know, it was the style, it was the modulation of the prose, it was the kind of, you know, gathering of detail, all that stuff. But above all, it was that, you know, in the best stories, that largeness of vision that really did it for me. And, you know, I'd already been writing stories for years, and very terrible they were, believe me. But now I knew I wanted to do this. I wanted to, you know, do stuff like Lovecraft. And so I began to write fan fiction, you know, using Lovecraft's mythos. But even then, I was trying to build on it and not just recycle. So, you know, I didn't want to write another, you know, Cthulhu story. So I, you know, picked up little references. So Bob Block had a passing reference in one story to Beatus, this entity that he invented, but he never said anything about it. Serpent bearded it was. That's the only thing he ever says. So I thought, well, okay, let's do a story about him. And I managed to incorporate, you know, some existing legends. And that was really my start in, as you say, the Lovecraftian.
So, yeah, I actually only just this, like 2 days ago, I think, I read a story called The Beard of Beatus. Mm-hmm. So it's weird mm-hmm. that you bring that up, because, yeah, it's a very not a widely known entity whatsoever.
He's not in the great pantheon, no, I grant you, but he's a second stringer, though. He's still pretty
good. For sure.
Good. Oh, he's still pretty monstrous, you know. You know, give him his monstrousness at least.
Oh, I'm definitely.
Sure. I know we do. I know we do. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Okay. Here we go. Speaking of Lovecraft's entities, which Lovecraftian entity is your favorite? Are you a Cthulhu guy? Are you a Azathoth guy?
Oh no, Yog-Sothoth! Come on, let's hear it for Yog-Sothoth. Who we do? You know, is the most mystical and the most mysterious, for sure. And we never really see him. I mean, we do get a bit of a description, which is, you know, a very curious and kind of, you know, alien geometrical kind of a description, mm-hmm. as I remember it. But you know, he I think sort of sums up the kind of, again, you know, the aspiration toward something larger than the narrative can describe. So the narrative has to be a kind of metaphor for it instead.
Yeah, definitely. That's Yog-Sothoth. I love that it is the everything of the universe, and how mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. I like the way you put it with not being able to fit in the narrative, because how you can't really describe that in a way that gives it form. Mm-hmm. So I like that. That's a good way of putting that. So speaking of, you mentioned Liverpool before, and as I understand it, I'll just get into it. How did the whole Brychester, Severn Valley all come to form? Did that? Please go ahead.
Sure. No, well, that was it. You see, okay, I wrote these several fan stories, basically, and then a friend of mine, Pat Kearney, Patrick J. Kearney, who is now a great historian of erotica, but he was then publishing a fanzine back in the early 60s from London. He was a great Lovecraft fan too, and he suggested I should send the stories to August Derleth, you know, just for Derleth's opinion, not you know, not to try and sell them to him, but, you know, just to get the opinion of, you know, who was the guy who was then really, you know, the expert on Lovecraft. So I duly wrote Derleth a letter saying, you know, dear Mr. Derleth, would you like to give me your opinion on these things? Well, I'm sure you had hundreds of such letters, you know, far too many from people you've never heard of. But he wrote back saying, well, look, we have to look at these because we own the copyright of the Lovecraft mythos. Well, that's obviously arguable, but okay, that's what he said, and that's fair enough. So, you know, you've got to let me see these stories before you attempt publication. Well, I wasn't actually thinking, except for fanzine publication, I've not really thought of anything, you know, any publication at all. So typed up the story, sent them to Derleth. After a while, I got this letter back from him saying, you know, these stories need a lot of work, which by gum they did, that's for sure. And, you know, you show too much and don't tell, you know, and you need to get the characters speaking to each other, which is odd because in my early, you know, bad kid, sort of juvenile stuff, I'd certainly had characters talking, but because I'd read Lovecraft, I thought, oh, well, there's no dialogue, so that must be the way to do it. You don't have any dialogue, which, you know, is a bit of a slavish attitude. Anyway, it does quite mm-hmm. rightly say, you know, okay, get the characters talking. And also, to answer your question, he said, basically, you know, you need to relocate the stories to somewhere. You don't use Lovecraft's, you know, Arkham settings, but find somewhere of your own in England. You know, they'll have, you know, some sort of individuality of their own. But Abdullah said this to me. This, I'm now 14 years old, remember? I'm 15. And he said, you know, as I say, it needs a lot of work, but if you're prepared to do all this stuff, and also if you have other, can write other stories in similar vein, we do think this may be an Arkham House book to publish. Well, you know, 15 years old, that's pretty fighting talk, you know. So, I, yeah. When I thought, how dare you tell me what to do with my stories? And then when I thought, my God, he's actually offering to publish them, and pick myself up the floor. And then, you know, got on with doing the editorial stuff and duly did and invented the, you know, the Britchester area down the Severn Valley. I mean, you have to say the Severn Valley was August's suggestion. Because, you know, the sort of Roman background, you know, possible Roman survivals, which I could tie in and did. And there were places around there that, you know, were, actually could be, you know, legends that I was able to incorporate. So I had some fun doing that. And so that is how Britchester came into being. But, you know, from being a sort of imitation, a sort of, if you like, a twin area to Arkham country, Britchester then in particular starts turning into a big urban metropolis, you know, and a lot more varied and certainly, you know, a lot seedier in some areas than Lovecraft's usually were. And so it took on a life of its own. And really it was Liverpool and all but name. And so eventually I thought, well, you know, why call it Britchester? Actually use Liverpool. And that's what I started doing.
Okay. All right. That's awesome. And then within that Severn Valley mythos, as I've seen it called.
Well, I mean, I say the Britchester mythos, in fact.
I'm sorry.
You're okay enough to calling it that now, yeah.
Okay, mm-hmm. The Britchester mythos. So the entities of your creation that I'm most familiar with are Glocky and Dowloth.
Yes, yes.
So for Glocky, how did the concept, my absolute favorite stories of yours are The Inhabitant of the Lake and The Revelations of Glocky.
Thank you.
I love that whole saga that goes on between those stories there. I would love to know about like the creation of that whole storyline and the creation of Glocky and just that whole valley along the lake there.
Now, do you know what my answer is going to be? I've no idea. I can't remember. I don't know. I mean, it just gradually came to me. You know, I wanted to do, you know, an entity, you know, something. I mean, Lord knows, not by any means as impressive as any of Lovecraft's, but you know, my own little contribution. And I suppose I just tried to come up with something original, you know, in terms of his shape and what he does to some extent. But then I have to say, you know, I think probably. You're thinking of The Last Revelation, are you? The novella, later one. So, you know, I went back to him, as you saw, and tried to do more with him. And I think, you know, tried to inject more of the cosmic into the story and had, you know, some fun doing it, I hope. Dowloth, as we call him. Now, he recurs in the trilogy that I did recently. Mm-hmm. Because, again, I mean, part of the reason for this was that my old friend Pete Crowther, PS Publishing. This was years ago now, but he said, you know, why don't you do a supernatural horror trilogy? Because nobody has done this, you know. It wasn't strictly true. In fact, there's I believe it's the Ghost House trilogy by Claire McNally that came out in the 80s as a paperback original in a slipcase. So there was that. And of course, by the time I actually got round to doing mine, which is, you know, it took me some years. Well, this is the point, you see. For me, the only reason to write a trilogy is if there is a reason to write a trilogy. You know, I don't want just to write a long novel and chop it into three volumes. It needs to have that form for me to want to do it at all. And eventually I thought, well, what about following the, you know, the central characters throughout most of their lives? You know, start in their, well, in their teens and then in their 40s and then, you know, in getting on old age, you know, in the last volume. And equally, the antagonists are aging, and equally, the antagonist's family is growing, and so is his influence. And so I thought, well, yeah, maybe there is something here. And ultimately, I did do the trilogy. And I must say, I'm kind of fond of that book, those books, you know. I mean, I'd never do another trilogy, but I'm very glad I did that one. Now, I have to say this. In the interim, of course, Jeff Vandermeer, you know, does the Southern Reach trilogy, which is very fine. But you know, I think there's room for two, and so I don't think they've got a huge amount in common, except that sort of sense of the cosmic from very different, you know, viewpoints, very different approaches. Yeah. But you know, Dayoloth. Now I can explain that one. Go back to the beginning for him, the Render of the Veils, which is was the original, you know, Dayoloth story. And this was actually from, because I'd asked Earth, you know, if I could do this. He'd, you may recall, written a number of stories which he called collaborations, you know, Lovecraft and Derleth. And basically he was taking notes Lovecraft had written for stories in his commonplace book and never got around to writing. So Derleth, you know, fleshed out these and wrote stories around them. So I asked, could I do the same? And he said, well, you know, okay, you know, so long as you don't, you know, reuse stuff that had already been done. And in a couple of cases, Lovecraft had simply transcribed the plot of a novel he had just read, not to use it himself, but just, you know, to have it there, I think. So there was a note, I'm only paraphrasing this, but it's something in the Lovecraft's note, is something like that life, the notion that life is an illusion with some hideous reality lurking behind it. I thought, hey, well, you know, there's a story there, and that's where Dayoloth ultimately came from. And, you know, having done him in The Render of the Veils, I thought, you know, recently, I thought, well, there is more that I could do with him. And so the trilogy was, well, one of the reasons for it was the result of that.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, the imagery, when you were creating Dayoloth, I've been pronouncing it Dowloth all this time.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's lucky because you don't invoke him that way.
True. Yeah, yeah. Good point. Yes. My ignorance is saving me yet
indeed
again.
Indeed.
But the imagery of Dayoloth is, I've seen fan art of it. Mm-hmm. I love it. It's like just different shapes all kind of mending together, but not. And when you look at it, and there's maybe eyes in there, just what, yes, was there anything in particular that inspired that imagery, or was it just, were you just trying to think of something creepy?
I was just trying to think of something, you know, difficult to describe. You describe mm-hmm. it, but you know, the description has got to be sufficiently alien to convey, you know, something you can't quite get your mind around, if you like. I mean, funny enough, I mean, there was a role playing game recently. Well, you know, one of the Cthulhu Mythos games, and they did this wonderful series of figurines of, you know, of my various creatures. Of course, they had to do poor old sculptor, you know, who had to do something or other to embody this idea, and he does extremely well with it, I think. But if he had known to wait, well, he wouldn't have, because I hadn't written it. But had he, you know, waited until I wrote the trilogy, I did find a different image, a sort of avatar of old Dayoloth, which is effectively a version of the womb of the worm Ouroboros, you know, the eternal cycle and so forth. So that shows up as the icon that people have in the trilogy. And that would, I think, be easier to sculpt, but you know, sorry about that, guy. You know, I wish I could have told you.
Oh, that's great. There's some really cool, really incredible stories coming out of those tabletop games, like the Cthulhu Mythos. I'm actually just starting now to try to get into like tabletop role playing games, and I'm going by way of the Cthulhu Mythos ones. And yeah, there's so many. I didn't realize how expansive that library is.
Oh gosh, yes.
I mean, there's so many novels and collections and anthologies from so many authors in the subgenre. It's incredible.
Yes, I know. I mean, but it's strange. You see, this is, of course, I mean, obviously, Lovecraft would have been astounded by his, you know, not only his success, but his, you know, his global fame and that of his creatures. But you know, I mean, in my own small way, let me not, you know, presume to be comparing. But what has happened, you know, is that old Dayoloth and Dlaki, They've taken on a life of their own, and they're out there, you know. And you've got innumerable paintings of them and drawings, and heavy metal bands are doing songs about them, and, you know, people are writing stories about them or incorporating them in stories. And it's astonishing. I mean, they're out of my control. So, you know, I've loosed them on the world, and I can only apologize and cower in a corner and hope they don't notice me.
And all we can do is thank you, because.
Well, there you go.
So shifting gears a little bit from the strictly Lovecraftian, strictly cosmic, are you a big horror movie guy?
Oh yes, yeah? For sure.
What kind of horror movies do you like?
All of them. Well, not every single one, but, you know, all kinds for sure. So, you know, from the highly supernatural to the, you know, to something like, say, Halloween, the original Halloween, which is a great movie, I think, but, you know, a very witty slasher movie. Now, I mean, a lot of the things that came after, you know, mistake they assume, you know, it's just more gore and more evisceration. Well, that's not really what the original was about. You know, it was very much more about, you know, dread and menace and visual wit. And actually, I've always said, you know, that if Val Lewton had been producing movies that late, that's the kind of slasher movie he might have made, because it feels to me very Lewton-esque, you know, very suggestive and atmospheric. But equally, you know, my all-time favourite horror movie is Night of the Demon. I mean, better known in America, I think, is Curse of the Demon. Dana Andrews, okay. Yeah, Peggy Cummins, and the wonderful...
I'm familiar with the title, yeah.
Listen, find it. It's out there. I mean, there's a great box set by Indicator, which I think must have been released in America as well. And it has every conceivable cut of the film, because there were two distinct edits of that film, one of which is about 8 minutes longer than the other. And the re-edited version actually rejigs the order of events as well. It isn't really shortening the movie. And both are worth seeing. But I mean, I just love that film. But equally, you know, what else? I mean, the only filmmaker who frequently terrifies me, whose work frequently terrifies me, you know, on an absolute gut level, is David Lynch. I mean,
of course,
Lost Highway, Fire Walk With Me, Mulholland Drive.
Blue Velvet.
Yeah, Blue Velvet, Inland Empire. But I've sort of figured this much out, or this is how it seems to me, that, you know, that just as Hitchcock used all the elements of cinema, you know, to convey a particular emotional experience, I mean, often, though not always, suspense, Lynch does that to convey a sense of the uncanny or the surreal, and, you know, but on that visceral level. And, you know, I mean, for instance, Lost Highway, probably my favourite, certainly in some ways. And, I mean, I found the first section of the film, you know, up to the point at which, you know, Bill Pullman is thrown into jail, I mean, almost too potent to watch. I genuinely have, you know, real, you know, whenever I put it on, I think, oh God, I'm going to do this to myself again. But, you know, but I do.
Why?
Yeah, why?
For sure. Yeah.
But there are good reasons. There are very good reasons. And, you know, I'm always glad I did. Now, the one we saw, I think it's, I'm not sure if it's a Shudder production, but it's certainly on the Shudder channel. And it's a controversial movie. Some people absolutely loathe it. But Jenny, my wife, and I, I mean, actually, genuinely were left shaken by it. And that's a movie called Speak No Evil.
I have also heard of that.
Scandinavian. Well, yeah. I'll say nothing about it, except it starts as a kind of comedy of embarrassment and social awkwardness and unease. But by gum, well, where it goes... The filmmakers didn't know it was going that way, but they followed it. And, well, you know, I'm sort of glad they did, but in a way, almost wish they hadn't. But that's all. That is all I shall say about that.
All right. I'll definitely check that one out.
Okay.
I don't mean to keep jumping around here.
No. Go on. And don't forget the Three Stooges. We've got to bring them in sometime.
But of course.
But you carry on.
So of the classic literary monsters. You got Dracula, Wolfman, Frankenstein, the Mummy. Were you into those when you were kind of forming your for horror?
Oh, sure. I mean, well, yes, certainly Frankenstein, certainly Dracula, which I read there was 11, I think. Funnily enough, Frankenstein was not that easy to find. At least if it was easy, I failed to do so, you know, in book form. So I'd actually seen the original James Whale, Boris Karloff movie, I believe. No, I'm sorry, I've got it wrong. I saw the original Hammer movie, that's what it was, The Curse of Frankenstein, Christopher Lee, Peter Cushing. That I saw before I managed to find the book in paperback. So that was an odd way around to do it. But, you know, and obviously in many ways, the Hammer version, and most film versions, you know, changed the novel a considerable amount. So I was a bit taken aback when I found the novel. And I think, you know, it's in many ways a philosophical novel, but a very fine one indeed. But certainly the concept of the monster, yeah, that was certainly kind of, you know, very much ingrained in me as I got started in the field. Now, I should explain one thing. Now, I know you're talking about fiction, literature, I mean, rather than film. But to come back to film for just a moment, the thing was that in Britain, nearly every horror movie had an X certificate. And that meant in those days, you've got to be over 15, or at least to appear, or, you know, to be taken, or be, you know, just nodded past the box office to get in to see it. And I'm talking about films like Plan 9 from Outer Space. That's an X, yeah. You're astounded I see this, but yes, it's true. So the thing was, you know, I was getting Famous Monsters of Filmland for years, the Fory Ackerman's magazine. So basically I'd seen a lot of stuff about these movies before I could ever see the films themselves. And so, you know, as soon as I turned, well, actually late 14, I think, you know, I thought, you know, I'm going to try and do this. And I did, you know, manage to persuade the guy in the pay booth, you know, the ticket booth, that I was 16. So I duly went in. And I think, well, Psycho was the very first. I thought with my mother, in fact, she wanted to see it. But my very first solo effort was a double bill of William Castle's Macabre, which ends by, or it actually insures you against death by fright. Well, that was William Castle's gimmick for that movie. And then with that, or the main feature actually, was by gum, 3D House of Wax. So that was,
oh, nice. Know,
one introduction to horror movie, you bet, you know. The only thing with the castle was, when you finally get to the moment where they open the coffin, I thought, Did I blink? What happened? What happened? And the reason was the British censors stepped in and snipped the image, so we didn't see what was in the coffin. Yes, that's right. It took me years to figure that out. Of course, you can see it now, but oh no, by gum, in those days, the British censor was a savage beast, believe you me.
Man.
I mean, all sorts of films fell foul of him. I mean, Mr. Sardonicus? You know, another William Castle movie. Yeah,
I know that one.
Oh, that's one of his better. It's by far his most gothic.
Okay.
But yes, I mean, the key moments in that were cut. So you got the build-up, and then basically you didn't see what it was built up to, which, believe me, is frustrating. So, you know, I had to wait years to see what was really behind that mask. But there you are. Janet did.
That had to have jaded your opinion on so many movies. These storytellers have no idea what they're doing.
Well, no, to be honest, I did figure pretty early on the censors been buggering about with this, you know, again. So usually it was insultingly obvious that, you know, something had been hacked out.
These days, frustrating.
Yeah. Now, these days, we have to say, though, they've had a change of heart. So anything pretty well gets passed. So we live in liberal times.
For sure. There's some incredible British horror that I've seen in recent years. The Ritual, I believe, was...
Oh, yes.
I think that was a British production.
It was.
Have you heard of the film Kill List?
Kill List, yes, I know it well.
Ben Wheatley, that's one of my favorite movies of the last 20 years.
It's very good, yes. I mean, I've seen it several times, and, you know, I think I've sorted out a little bit more each time. But, you know, I did a column for Video Watchdog for quite a number of years, and I did, in fact, do a column on Kill List offered my exegesis. In fact, all those columns are now collected in a book from PS Publishing, along with the Three Stooges book. There we are. See, we've got them in there again.
There you go. as many times as we need to bring up Three Stooges, please feel free.
Fair enough.
Drop it in the middle of a monologue.
Please. I'll do that. Maybe you know there's a connection between Lovecraft and the Three Stooges now.
Yeah, yep.
Which I didn't know, but no, there's a comic, by gum, The Three Stooges versus Cthulhu. I believe it's
that
actually,
I didn't know.
Look it up online. Believe me, it's there. That's there. So
I've seen so many weird pairings of Cthulhu and other characters. There was a web comic, I believe. There's a kids' TV show character called Pepper Ann, and it was Pepper Ann meets Cthulhu.
Yes,
and
yes.
I recently supported a Kickstarter for a comic. Cthulhu invades Neverland.
Ah, okay.
So it's like, yeah, I'm excited to finally get that one. I think it's going to be interesting to see all C.S. Lewis's stuff with Lovecraft mixed in there.
I think so. Yeah, yeah.
It's an interesting concept just because of just how bizarre Neverland is and all of its inhabitants.
Yeah.
So it's going to be interesting.
You bet.
But actually back to Kill List, I cannot sing that one's praises enough. Which that brings me to probably my favorite British horror film of all time. The connection there is obvious, is The Wicker Man.
Yes.
And that's just an absolute classic. And I remember seeing that one when I was a kid. My uncles were watching it and it scared the hell out of me. I watched it as an adult and it doesn't so much scare me now. I mean obviously I don't have the same sensibilities as I did when I was 10 or whatever, but it's a completely different sort of feeling that film gave me, and it's just so, I don't know, it's hard to explain the feeling that I get from that movie, but it encompasses everything I love about horror. It's not, I wouldn't even call it my favorite horror movie, but I always think that The Wicker Man is like the perfect horror movie.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. What kind of horror movies did you watch growing up? As you kind of, again, developed into the horror aficionado you are? What scared you as a kid?
Oh, well, I mean, again, you see, I couldn't really see them as a kid unless they had less than an X certificate. The very first that scared me deeply, now we're talking about 3 years old here, you understand, but I could have been older and it would still do it, was the original Disney Snow White. Deeply terrified me. Well, two things in particular, one of which was the magic mirror. Because I think it was the whole thing about looking in the mirror and not seeing your own face, which, you can do if you've dropped acid, but I didn't know that then. But there's something deeply disturbing about this, even then for me. And the other thing, which is, I mean, I think has to tell us a lot about me and why I write what I write, if you like. What is supposed to be, the light relief scene when the dwarfs do a song and dance for Snow White, it's lots of fun. But the thing was this, in the background of a lot of those shots, there was a window, open on the forest. There was just blackness outside. And every time that wretched window came up, I was certain somebody was going to appear at it and peer in, And clearly I was already creating my own fiction because it never did. So that was the first thing. Two others, lordy. One's perfectly understandable, I think. That was This Island Earth, to some extent directed by Jack Arnold, who made Tarantula and several other, and Creature from the Black Lagoon, actually. He was quite a veteran of the, but he's not credited, but he made the last reel of the film, I think. And there's a mutant in that, which is really pretty monstrous, actually, the old Metaluna mutant. For some reason, this movie got a U certificate, which meant, suitable for everybody. Believe me, as I cowered nearly beneath the seat in front, it seemed to me this probably wasn't suitable for everybody, certainly not for me when I was like 10 years old. So that certainly got to me. There was one other, and this persisted for a long time in my memory. It's a Danny Kaye movie. Now, you know, well, Danny Kaye may be frightening in a different way, but that's a different issue. A movie called Knock on Wood, which is sort of an attempt to do a kind of Hitchcock comedy thriller. You know, if you'd cast, say, Cary Grant or James, well, not so much James Stewart, because he's very much more neurotic for Hitchcock, but certainly Cary Grant. In the case of Danny Kaye, he's a ventriloquist. A spy, or I think a member of an espionage organization, has secreted a microfilm in Danny Kaye's dummy, the ventriloquist dummy. And there are now two espionage operations, you know, out to get this. So they one of them breaks into Danny Kaye's London flat while Kaye is out. The other guy gets in, you know, while he is searching, and flings a knife, which pins the guy to the back of a door, and a hat falls over his face, or his, I suppose, the back of his head, whatever it is. So Danny Kaye comes in, the other fellow scarpers, and the joke is, you know, how long will it take Danny Kaye to realize, no, that's not a hat and coat hanging on the back of the door? And, you know, the audience was sort of, you know, laughing and guffawing around me. And I was in utter panic, you know, this nightmare of this bloody corpse on the back of a door and not realizing it's there. And this did not strike me as being remotely funny. And the fact that people were laughing at it made it twice as hideous, you see. So that lodged in my mind for a long, long time. And oddly enough, I remembered it as going on far longer than it did. In fact, when I finally, you know, rediscovered the film, it's only a kind of a quite brief gag. And it's a very kind of feeble attempt to do a Hitchcock thriller. But, you know, even so, that stayed in my mind for such a long time that I actually wrote a version of it into a novel called The Nameless, where there's something on the back of the door, but it's not a corpse, it's something else. But yeah, you know, that, so I rid myself of the trauma, finally, that way.
I just had the image in my mind of 10-year-old Ramsey Campbell, like, why are you people laughing at this? Yes.
On the other hand, you see, the opposite has all happened to me. Because, you know, Jenny and I, we love our favourite Coen Brothers movie by far is Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Which, here it comes again, is clearly a Three Stooges tribute. And I'll say that for nothing, because the film The Chain Gang goes to see in the cinema, if you remember that scene, that's actually a Three Stooges film. They don't appear in the shot, in the clip. It's a movie called Mert and Marge. And it was one of the films in which, you know, they had cameo appearances, or, you know, they were secondary characters. And they don't appear in what we see. But Jack Haley, whose Stooges they were, does appear. But here's the thing about this. You see, Jenny and I, first time we saw it at the cinema in Liverpool. And we got that scene of, you know, basically, John Turturro, isn't it? Saying, you know, do not seek the treasure. We thought it was turned into a horny toad. Do not see. And we were sort of falling about laughing. And all the people in front of us were turning around, staring, and clearly thinking, who are these insane people? Should we get them thrown out? Which is twice as disturbing, you know. So there you go.
So it flipped back on you years
exactly.
later.
Exactly. That's right.
You were
that's
the
right.
one, yeah.
Yes, we're the monsters. The monsters are us.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I always forget that Oh Brother, Where Art Thou was a Coen Brothers film. I mean, I've seen it several times, but yeah, my favorite Coen Brothers is No Country for Old Men.
That was very fun. Yeah.
Anton Chigurh is one of the most terrifying antagonists outside of a horror film.
Very much so.
I've ever seen.
Mind you, he comes out of Cormac McCarthy, so what do you expect?
Exactly. Yeah, I'm sure you've read Blood Meridian.
Yes. Oh, Lord. Yes.
Yeah. I would love to see the Coen brothers' take on that.
Yes. Well, of course, there have been attempts, haven't there? Apparently, you know, they've got shelled because it was going to be so bloody that nobody would go anywhere near it. But there's a rumor that somebody's... It's not Billy Bob Thornton, is it? Somebody's looking to do it at the moment, I do believe. So maybe this time, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully there's I think from what I gather, there's kind of always rumors of like, oh, this person is attached or this person is showing interest in it. And, and I mean, as I'm sure you know, nothing is really happening until it's happening.
Well, so certainly not in film. It's not, that's for sure.
Right. Yeah. That's what I mean. Yeah. So it's hard to say. But yeah, no, I'd love to see it because McCarthy had a just an incredible way of writing villains that weren't like, I don't like the Judge to me, and many others. It's not like I'm unique in this thought, but that is quite possibly the most terrifying villain ever.
Created. Oh yeah, no, I'm with you there. Yes, by certain. Mind you, did you ever see The Counselor, the Ridley Scott movie?
Yes.
Yep. Well, I mean, Cameron bloody Diaz is pretty terrifying in that.
For sure.
Yeah, yes. Which is a real surprise.
Yeah, that one, I didn't know when I saw that, I didn't know that was based on a McCarthy novel.
I think it's an original script he wrote, isn't it?
Oh, is it? Oh, okay. You're right. Mm. I think you're right. And I was just about to say, and I haven't read the novel. That's probably why.
Yes. Too late now because he won't write it. But there
you are. Right. Unfortunately, may he rest in peace.
Yeah.
He has a way with, like, with the Judge and with Chigurh, and they are so kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? They're not like outwardly, like if you walked by them and they didn't turn their attention on you, you would never know that they were these heinous, just awful individuals. And sure. I love that. They're unassuming.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
probably the word I was looking for, unassuming. And
I think there is a sort of sense of the uncanny to them as well, I think, you know, particularly the Judge.
For sure, the Judge. And even Chigurh, he's presented as this sort of unstoppable force of nature.
That's right.
And I think they may actually even describe him as such in the film. But yeah, the Judge especially, I mean, there's so much potentially supernatural going on in Blood Meridian just kind of lurking there in the background. And the Judge in particular is just this, like, I mean, I don't want to root, it's a however many decades old book, but like, he's so, I mean, they describe him as being like 7 feet tall, but yet he moves as swiftly as a gazelle, and he's all these weird, this like contradictions of size and speed and just, and it really comes through in the writing.
Oh,
and
very much so. Yes.
I gotta admit, it is so difficult for me to get through Cormac McCarthy books. Just because I love them very much, but it's just the writing style. I personally could never write like that. I don't get like the lack of punctuation and quotes, and obviously you fall into it as you go along. But it's I have a hard enough time keeping my mind focused on a traditionally written book, so when it comes to McCarthy, it takes me a while. Are there any authors currently that you're reading, or like what's on your nightstand now that you're reading?
I'm going to have to look this up because dependent on the mobile phone here. I'm just going to check what the guy's name is, because I have right now I'm reading a novel which has not yet been published. And I mean, well, people send a lot of these things to me, you know what I mean? And it is a novel by, and I'm going to tell you in a minute, at least I hope I am, because this interminably prolonged interlude, otherwise it's going to frustrate everyone really very deeply, isn't it? Anyway, what's this guy's name? Yeah, Gareth Wood. You've not heard of him, but I think you may in the future.
Nice.
I mean, it's I think it's an unedited it's not been through editing yet, but there's a real sort of raw power to it that I found very impressive. So it was just sent to me by one of my editors, it's impressive. I also just read the new novel by Daniel Church, who is a friend and also fellow English horror writer, called The Ravening, which is very powerful stuff. I mean, both just a surely compelling narrative, and also sort of monsters that are all too human, but also one monster that spectacularly isn't, verges on the cosmic. So this is stuff I like, and I'm very pleased with that. I've just done a quote for that.
Nice.
And, you know, there's all, I mean, also, you know, in my spare moments between reading stuff that, you know, people have sent me, I, you know, dip back into Kingsley Amis and, you know, Robert Aitken and the like. But I'm more and more aware there's not enough time, you know.
Not enough hours in the day.
No, that's right. Oh, now the other thing I read very recently was Graham Greene's first novel, which is very strange. I remember reading it, when I started working in the public libraries back in the late 60s. And I thought, yeah, Graham Greene was one of my absolute favourite writers. And this was his first published novel. And I was very taken aback because it was a sort of historical adventure involving smugglers and, you know, the excise men. I thought, well, yeah, this isn't like Green at all. And I picked it up again very recently and thought, well, I'll give it another shot. What's interesting, yes, it's very much like Green, except the setting, which, you know, he would always, other than that, he was a contemporary setting. But it's all, the green is all there. I mean, you know, an early scene with a clergyman, you know, doing a funeral while he's got a terrible cold. It's pure Graham Greene. But it reads like a first unedited draft of Graham Greene. And, you know, he will later refine all this, to distill it. And it's a weird thing because, you know, this is what I've tried to do over the decades with my own stuff. So, you know, kind of feel it's worth doing, you know.
Yeah, for sure. And then just one last question. What can we expect from you next? Are you working on, do you have any novels? I mean, I'm sure you can't really say much about anything.
Yes, all the time. You better believe it. I mean, this is the 60th anniversary of that first published book, The Inhabitant of the Lake. So PSP Publishing are going to do a special limited signed illustrated edition, very limited hardcover. Awesome. And then Flame Tree Press, by splendid mass market publishers, they've got my new novel for November, a book called The Incubations, which is about twin towns and what comes back from one of them, you know, brought by a visitor to the other one, which I'm sure you'll appreciate will be uncanny and very terrible. They're going to do a limited edition of that, together with a Lovecraft collection and an M.R. James collection that I've done special introductions to. It's going to be a sort of uniform trilogy, not quite a trilogy, but a uniform triad, if you like. And I've just got through the dispiriting process of rereading the first draft of next year's novel, a book called An Echo of Children. And at this point, all I can see is all that's wrong with it. And by God, there's a lot. But, you know, these days, at least I can tell myself, well, that's what rewriting is for. You know, you see the problem, you're on the way to fixing it. And the rewrite starts tomorrow, at which point I become ruthless and merciless with the whole thing. And, you know, as I didn't used to be enough, but these days I am. So watch out, first draft. I'm coming for you.
I love it. All right. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Campbell. I really appreciate you coming on here and talking to me.
My pleasure, man. My pleasure. And don't forget my book. I know it's out now, so it's not quite a new thing, but Three Stooges and Counting is my study of the Three Stooges.
Where can people find that? Where, if people want more Ramsey Campbell, where can they go?
Oh, well, you know, Amazon have got it, Barnes & Noble have got it, anywhere like that, and the publisher's PS as well. And not least, it includes the episode of Room 237, which you may know is, you know, the documentary film about what The Shining, the Kubrick film, was really about. Well, my two-page contribution is that the entire film is a tribute to the Three Stooges. And I adduce a great deal of evidence, but you must read it for yourselves.
All right. I will have a link down to that book in the show notes and the description of this video. All right. Thank you again, Mr. Campbell. You have a good day, sir.
You too, man. You too.